Hello, and welcome to the Forward Podcast. Today on our show, web editor Gabrielle Berkner sits down with author Elisa New to discuss her historical memoir, Jacob's Cain. But first, here's editor Jane Eisner with a look at what's in the April 2nd edition of the Forward. Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Nadja. You know, this was quite a week for news about the Israeli-American relationship. And our reporter, Natan Gutman, was covering the AIPAC conference and writing a lot for this paper about what's going to happen to the peace process in the days and months ahead. But we also, I think, have a pair of columns that readers might find interesting, looking at the tenure of Bibi Netanyahu as Prime Minister of Israel. It's been just a year. And we asked two superb writers to give us their assessment. Evelyn Gordon is a writer and commentator for Commentary magazine. In her opinion, Netanyahu has done exceedingly well in navigating all the bumps and curves that have occurred in Israel and with Israel's relationships with the United States and other countries. She feels that Netanyahu has picked his battles wisely. Yossi Alfer, on the other hand, disagrees. He is a regular columnist for us and from Israel, and he believes that it's really going to be impossible going forward for Netanyahu to pursue a peace process and to stare down the Iran nuclear threat whilst holding on to a coalition government that is beholden to very far right-wing politics and policies. So I think that the two of them provide very interesting and contrasting insight. You know, we also have another kind of offbeat but fascinating piece by a fellow named Jerry Mueller. And here's how it began. We've been wondering during this economic downturn whether it has hurt Jews, whether people are in this country or elsewhere willing to blame the Jews as they have in so many other periods of economic turmoil. We realized that there had just been a book called Jews and Capitalism written by Jerry Mueller. And we thought, well, he'd be the guy to answer the question, wouldn't it? And so he did in a fascinating piece that explains why this economic downturn has not targeted the Jews, especially in America. There are all sorts of reasons, and I don't want to give away everything, but certainly the fact that Jews have become so much more embedded in government, economic, and political life in this country helps that to ward off a kind of anti-Semitism, which, as we know, is so often been based on the other. The other thing he points out, one of the other things, is interesting, which is that Jews don't dominate Wall Street. So even though it might seem like we do, in fact, we don't, and perhaps that dawned upon people that that's the case. We also have a fascinating piece from Israel from our Israeli correspondent, Nathan Jaffe. You know, for time immemorial, certainly since biblical times and through the time of Jesus, we've always had this image of the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, as a place where people fish. Well, it turns out that there aren't very many fish left in the Sea of Galilee. And as a result, the Israeli government has banned fishing there for 2 years. This ban is going to start in April. It does not make the fishermen around the Kinneret very happy at all, even though apparently they are going to be compensated for their loss of income. But it does change the nature of what we do in at a body of water that I think is very, very important to Jews, Christians, and all sorts of people for millennia.
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Also this week, Benjamin Ivry on Jules Feiffer's angry new memoir, cartoonist Ellie Valley on Star Wars and Intermarriage, and an audio slideshow with Orthodox feminist artist Jacqueline Nichols. Find all these stories and more online at www.forward.com. Now stay with us as web editor Gabrielle Berkner interviews author Elisa New.
For Elisa New, the discovery of her great-grandfather's cane inspired a decade-long journey to unravel her mysterious family story. Her new book about that story is Jacob's Cane, A Jewish Family's Journey from the Four Lands of Lithuania to the Ports of London and Baltimore. It's about her transatlantic quest to separate family history from family lore. Alisa New is a professor of English at Harvard, where she teaches American literature. She recently visited the Forward Studio to discuss her travels, her book, and what she makes of a new crop of television shows about genealogy. How did this ornate monogrammed cane owned by your great-grandfather Jacob inspire this book?
I first saw Jacob's cane around 11 years ago when I was visiting some elderly relatives and asking them questions about the past. And they didn't really want to answer. In some exasperation at a certain point, my cousin Buddy said to me, "Well, you know, I have it. I have your great-grandfather Jacob's cane if you ever want to see it." I did a double take, and I came back to Baltimore a few weeks later and found in this cane a kind of treasure map and Rosetta Stone that answered questions about my ancestry that I'd always sort of had. It had the names of towns. Towns no one had ever been able to identify before are inscribed on it. I was able to begin a journey that took me first to the Baltics, but then through London, and then back to Baltimore, and actually deep into American history as well.
So you write in the book that you had imagined your ancestors as these Teviots, and what you found was very different than that. Tell me about what you found that debunked that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the account kids of my generation got of the immigrant experience, it was invariably called the immigrant experience, was an account of Jews who came from small, muddy, religious, backward places in Europe, who came to America invariably through New York, who worked in miserable sweatshops, who struggled and struggled all that their children might have a better life. That really was, as I was growing up, the canonical story of Jewish immigration. My own family story had always been a little perplexing, and maybe this is why I hadn't thought. I just thought there was something wrong with us. When I would ask my great aunts, you know, when had we come from New York? I remember asking that, and they'd say, "We weren't from New York. We were from," and this is how they pronounced it, "we were from Baltimore." They pronounced the word Baltimore as though it meant we were from a very special place. Eventually, as I began to research my family's past and research their claims of our great distinction, I saw, of course, how much mythologizing went into that claim, but also came to understand that Baltimore was a very different kind of immigrant port, of host city for immigrants, one that absorbed a disproportionately large number of Jews from German-speaking Europe, all across the Baltics. And my ancestors had come from the Baltics. They certainly, I'm sure, spoke Yiddish, although my aunts claimed they didn't.
Isn't that interesting? My Austrian grandmother also
insisted.
You know, right. I don't speak Yiddish. There's this very, like, I speak High German.
That's right. Well, my aunts would even insist that the language spoken by any self-respecting German Jews in Baltimore was obviously English. And the story I uncovered was, I like to think, a story of the Jewish Enlightenment, a story of Jews who embraced not only modern ways of studying holy texts, but also embraced science and technology and welcomed modernity.
In order to write this book, it required a lot of travel to Europe. And you went with your daughter, your young daughter, who was, I guess, 12, on your first trip. How do you think your journey would have been different if you hadn't had your daughter with you?
One of the nicest reviewers said that this book reminded him of a Victorian novel full of betrayal, mm-hmm. and angry fathers. And The book has two main protagonists. One is my great-grandfather. The other is a man who was my great-great-uncle, intermarried with the family in various ways. My great-great-uncle invented a cigarette machine, and he sold it in Europe, became fabulously wealthy, and he was missing only one thing, and that was a real management team to support him in this cigarette enterprise of his. And so he, as the family stories have it, he stole my great-grandfather's sons away from him. My great-grandfather's three oldest sons left their father behind in Baltimore and Philadelphia, crossed the ocean, and joined a man who had once been his friend and now was his bitter enemy. And the story I tell over several generations of the friendship of these men and the consequences of one man taking another man's sons and the feelings and curses issued and imprecations and wills, insulting wills drawn up, etc., like a Victorian novel. That story of parents and children and of intergenerational stress, I think, became more came more to the fore because as I was coming to tell this story, I too was raising children, several of them, but also I was partnering increasingly with a child so much like me. I mean, we enjoyed so many shared interests and goals as the years went on, and I think I was filled with pity and tenderness for my great grandfather, mm-hmm. who had lost all of that.
Right. You talked about his curse, and his curse was to his three sons.
May you never have sons. And the funny thing is that they never did have sons.
Right.
They did have daughters. They had lovely daughters who then went on and had sons.
While you were writing this book, you got married to economist Larry Summers. So you were writing this book about your family history at a time when your family was growing. Do you think that your marriage shaped this book in any way?
Some writers work better and see more clearly when they're unhappy, but mm-hmm. I think I'm not one of those.
Okay.
And I think that growing happiness made me understand the human dimensions of my story better, made me unafraid of its sad corners. I started the book several years before I met my husband Larry, and it was a hard time of life. I do tell the story in the book, and I reflect on how it sometimes crossed my mind that getting married, having a chuppah put into the wasp bastion of the Harvard president's house, since I married Larry when he was Harvard president, might be my most significant contribution to Jewish culture. But I did really want to finish this book, and Larry was sure I would. My children said they were sure I would. I wasn't sure.
Now we're seeing a lot of like television shows and like a really renewed interest, a lot of genealogy blogs, mm-hmm. a lot of people, really exploring their family history. What do you make of, the Henry Louis Gates show?
I do think that there's a resurgence of interest in history overall. And I mean, you think of the shows like The History Detective. I mean, even the children's shows like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Right.
I think that there's something really exciting about a worldwide treasure hunt. I think that lots of people like me have elderly relatives whom they press and press for information about the past, and they find themselves frustrated. But I think it's just a basic human desire, and one now in some way firmed up by history shows. Certainly, I think the stories that I uncovered about my family are pretty interesting, but it turns out that most families' stories are really interesting.
Elisa New, the author of Jacob's Cain, A Jewish Family's Journey from the Four Lands of Lithuania to the Ports of London and Baltimore. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed being here.
That's it for the Forward Podcast. Thank you for listening. For Forward.com, I'm Nadja Spiegelman.